Welcome to AI in Journalism. I'm Yumi Wilson, a journalism professor, branding expert, and your host. In this podcast, we'll boldly explore the intersection of AI and journalism from its origins to its implications for newsrooms. We'll discuss the symbiosis of AI and human judgment, ethical concerns, and most importantly, arm you with the knowledge to navigate this brave new world. Whether you're a budding journalist, seasoned editor, or simply an AI enthusiast, join us as we fearlessly uncover the future of journalism in the age of artificial intelligence. Welcome to AI in Journalism.
Imagine a world where AI doesn't just assist journalists, but fundamentally transforms how they create, consume, and distribute news. That world isn't just on the horizon, it's already here. Our guest today is at the forefront of this seismic shift. Pete Paschal has been the oracle of tech trends at some of the most influential publications, including Mashable and PC Mag. He's seen firsthand how technology has reshaped our world. But Pete isn't just observing change, he's driving it. As the founder of the Media Copilot, he has built a platform that has quickly become the go-to resource for understanding AI's impact on media. From interviewing comedy legend Cedric the Entertainer, one of my favorites, to grilling the leaders of cutting-edge AI companies, Pete has his finger, let's say on the pulse, of this rapidly evolving field. His unique blend of tech expertise and media savvy makes him the perfect guy to help us navigate the AI revolution in journalism. Pete, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Yumi. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for that very thoughtful intro.
It took a while, you know? It takes time. But learning about you has been very much eye-opening. I thought I knew a lot about you, but just learning about the two decades of the kind of coverage that you've done, the journalism that you've done, you've worked at Mashable, PC Mag. How has your experience in these roles shaped your understanding of technology's role in society, especially as it relates to AI?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So I've been a tech journalist for, as you said, going on two decades, going on three. And it sort of never fails to amaze me what, you know, comes out of Silicon Valley. And I spent a good chunk of the 2010s at Mashable, and I was the tech editor there. And that was a great place to be, not just to observe technology, but to observe what it was doing to the media industry, because Mashable was a very digital-first brand. And if it was known for anything other than being kind of a nice version of BuzzFeed, it was also known for diving into platforms headfirst and wanting to be out first and sort of getting to know them and getting to understand their quirks and how they reach audiences. And so that was a very, very good place to be to just understand how digital media was changing. We did everything from live video to long form to social content. I was immersed in it all. So when I moved on later to CoinDesk, where I was chief of staff for a few years, I leveraged a lot of that knowledge to sort of figure out what CoinDesk's platform and how it would reach audiences. And that involved a lot of things from newsletters to Web3 applications. But one of the most exciting things I worked on there was AI. And that was right when ChatGPT landed on the scene in late 2022. I knew kind of instantly, like, wow, this was going to change a lot of things and how we do journalism and how we do media. So I sort of convened an internal team to look at it. We came up with some guidelines. I authored the external guidelines on how we would use AI with regard to content. And then we started figuring out some use cases and figuring out like how we could maybe apply this. And like many organizations, we learned it's probably not that good at doing content at scale. Luckily, we never tried to do it in a public way like some other brands might have. But we did see it did have some uses. And while we only sort of got to field a couple of them in the time I was there, when I went out on my own later, I knew I wanted to do something with AI. some of the most satisfying stuff I did was when I was with CoinDesk and figuring out their approach to AI and AI with regard to content. So that's why I founded the Media Copilot. And I called it Copilot before Microsoft fully appropriated the term, it seems like. It's really more meant to refer to the what I would argue is the proper way to think about AI as sort of an assistive technology and a copilot with you in the pilot seat. And really wanted to figure out how, not only how AI was changing media, but how journalists in particular could use it to further their work, further their careers. And, you know, in terms of media professionals, I also speak often to PR professionals, marketers. As you'd expect, there's a lot of overlap with regard to content creation and the apps and the techniques. So that's what I've been doing ever since. I teach classes on AI fairly regularly, usually to private groups, but also publicly through my website, mediacopilot.ai. And I do some consulting too with various newsrooms and companies in terms of solving some harder problems with AI. So it's been all AI all the time. And even I feel kind of overwhelmed by the rate of pace of how it's evolving and the number of apps and services that tend to come out on a now daily basis.
You had mentioned you started Media Copilot. And by the way, yes, that name did catch me for a second because I did see that. Wait.
Yeah, everyone asks.
Right? So, but CoinDesk, you were at CoinDesk and you discovered that AI is going to definitely be a part of the equation in journalism. You start coming up with a plan. What happened from CoinDesk? How did the change happen to Media Copilot?
Well, CoinDesk was in the midst of a big downturn in the crypto industry, brought out in part because of the story exposing FTX and SBF. I won't go into all that here, but there was a big contraction in the industry. It ended up affecting CoinDesk. Again, ironically, because they broke the story on all that stuff. And then there were a number of layoffs. I found myself in one of them and just started looking for my next move. And again, I sort of looked around, thought about everything that was changing. And also I could see the crescendoing layoffs in media at the time. So there was a lot of, even though those layoffs weren't necessarily directly AI related, AI is an accelerant to all this, making a lot of companies very nervous. It's making a lot of people think about getting leaner with respect to doing more with less. And so, it's been a difficult time for media, but at the same time, AI has tremendous potential. You know, there's a lot of things that can help with regard to journalists doing their jobs. And there are ways it has been abused, I guess I would say, by media companies, but I feel like we've kind of been through that at this point, and there's a lot of exploration of better use cases with regard to AI, and you've seen it as, again, an assistive technology. I think the companies, media companies that are doing it correctly are using it in a way that helps guide coverage and helps usually at the two sides of the pipeline, the two ends of the pipeline, as opposed to the story creation middle of the pipeline. There's sort of the research surfacing of information that you otherwise wouldn't have found. I think a company that's doing this really well is Semaphore. They do a format called Semaphore Signals. It helps reporters find information on their beat across the world, right? In multiple languages. Because, you know, if you only speak one or two languages, you're only going to sort of find content in those languages. This will sort of pull in more and give you essentially a first draft of it. But then the reporter will take that and write their own. And then it's mostly reporter written what a signal story is. But it's an accelerant. It gives you more information faster and lets you get to that end product later. And then in the other end of the pipeline is where a lot of low-hanging fruit is. It's sort of like the social copy, the SEO headlines, the meta descriptions. This is stuff AI is really, really good at, actually. And it's also stuff that journalists happen to not really like doing, at least in my experience, that sort of chrome around an article once you've done telling that story. There's a whole bunch of things that journalists had to learn to do over the past decade and a half. They had to essentially become content marketers in addition to journalists. And now a little bit of that is retracting. And I find that a very kind of persuasive thing to skeptical journalists of like, well, you know, you might be skeptical about what it can do with regard to reporting, but it can do this at least. It can make your life a little easier. And so that's sort of a foot in the door for AI in terms of journalistic processes, I find, and a pretty effective one.
In fact, I was interviewing Ryan Restivo, who created an app called YesEO. And yeah, so you are definitely mentioning something I'm hearing from others, which is if you can create a tool that will make it easier for a journalist, for anyone really, right? A communicator, a PR person, because you talked about that overlap. If you can make it easier for these folks to do their jobs, then it's of interest. But in the middle is this concern, right? You know, so yes, you can help me with the headlines, you can help me with fact checking, you can help me with research. But what happens to this idea of, will you be able to just, you know, will these tools be able to do the jobs of journalists? Is that a real concern?
Not right now. Not real journalism. And I'm going to be a little harsh with some forms of journalism right now, but real journalism is finding facts that are new, whether that's a source telling you something that hasn't previously been reported, whether that's a scoop of insight, so to speak, on sort of putting information together in a novel way and adding a little bit of your judgment, usually something done for senior writers or senior reporters, or just reporting facts on the ground, you know, spot news. AI can't do that. What AI is really good at, though, is what I would classify as aggregation. So there's a story that's broken. I want to rewrite it in my own brand's voice, maybe add a bit of a take, you know, that's probably borders on blogging. But the idea of re-reporting things became a very, and still is, a very large part of what digital journalism sort of ended up being because of the incentives that social and search created. And even though a pretty good shorthand developed out of that, how to attribute properly when headlines in the lead, generally you wouldn't do a, you know, word-for-word rewrite or even complete rewrite, even if it was changed. There were a certain way of doing it that didn't make it great, but it made it a little more tolerable. That, I think we're seeing now, is a very much an AI task. In fact, that's kind of what they do now and what a lot of people are concerned about, because they're doing what journalists had done for a long time, aggregation, but they're doing it at scale, and they're doing it generally without linking much. They link a little bit, but, and I'm, you know, caveating that with there are services that aren't purely generative from a training corpus. So like Perplexity is a big example. It's an AI plus a search engine, and it does a lot of attribution. ChatGPT just came out with SearchGPT. I think it's still private, invite only, but the intent is to turn that into a product. And so this aggregation function, something AI does really, really well. And in fact, some news organizations are starting to use that aspect of it to summarize their own articles. So essentially a long article, well, you can get the bullets now at the top. And often that's written by an AI. The reporter didn't do that. It's more of that chrome around a piece that is best left to a machine. That, to me, is healthy for the media ecosystem. I think the age of aggregation, again, it's not like aggregation is a totally new thing. We had digests, Reader Digest and whatever, even in the print era, and you would do, you know, a lot of digest reporting in radio, for example. But aggregation can start to be more, a chunk of it can start to be more and more offloaded to machines. And then reporters are then tasked with and challenged to go out and do real reporting. Again, I think that's actually generally healthy for the industry. I think it's healthier for the reporters. I think you're going to be working better muscles, and you're going to be bringing the thing that AI will have, I think, a lot of difficulty ever bringing, which is that human ingenuity, that human insight, the human creativity, and just the simple human ability to talk to people, right? Even if an AI could theoretically call a source, think about that. Like, it would disclose it's an AI. Is a source really going to tell you the same kind of stuff that it would tell to a human, to an AI? I mean, you know, maybe if we're talking hundreds of years in the future and it's C-3PO or whatever, but then you're just in science fiction land. So no, I don't think it's ever going to fully replace journalists. But in terms of what we define as journalism in the media ecosystem today, it's going to take away some of that stuff that probably shouldn't have been that big a piece of the media ecosystem anyway.
Should the definition or the description of the job change? And more specifically, should students and others coming into this industry be thinking about different skills and thinking about, okay, what will be the perfect picture to have so I can get a job or do good journalism?
Yeah, I think at its purest, it doesn't change in terms of the definition of what journalism is. Although some people have different definitions. One of the definitions I really always took to was publishing things someone doesn't want to get published. I always kind of like that as a good definition of journalism. But I think a lot of the skills and expectation around it is going to change. You know, bottom line, journalists with AI skills are going to do better than journalists without them. Just as a research tool alone, even if you just zero in on that one use case, an AI can do a lot more in the journalistic process. But that alone, it gives you so much good directional data and directional guidance. If you are coming into something cold, particularly if you're not, you haven't been immersed on a beat for like 5, 10, 20 years, it's going to save you tons of time. You just think about like you're a court reporter and you might be relatively new to a case. And you need these documents analyzed and you could spend all night checking them out and getting up to speed. And you probably should at some point, but well, you know, the daily deadline of journalism is still needed and you're going to want to turn to a ChatGPT or what have you to summarize these documents and give you some directional data. Now, again, I think the danger lies in the sort of proper use of it in that you don't want it as a replacement. You don't want to say like, okay, I did that. Now I never need to read the document. Or I don't need to check whether that was the best tidbit or the best summarization. I think you do need to do that at some point and build that muscle memory of being able to do it. But again, it all comes down to discipline and ensuring that, you know, if assuming you take your job seriously, you're going to make time for that. And the AI, though, can get you started on a lot of projects faster than you otherwise would have. But I should just spend a more moment on that muscle memory bit, because I think it is important. Because when you think about like the proper use of AI, which I keep mentioning and alluding to, I think it's really important that even just because an AI can do something in most cases, it doesn't necessarily mean it should in all cases. And I mean that both for the individual and the organization. It's kind of like, you know, you just use the analogy of weightlifting. Like if the point is to do as many reps as possible, then sure, let a robot lift your weights for you. If the point is to build muscle, it makes no sense. You know, like why would you do that? So, you know, there's at some point you need to build that muscle. And again, it's the analogy breaks down a bit because often, you know, doing the reps isn't the point. There's no sort of added thing there that is of value. But looking at AI, you really need to, as an organization, think about not just the muscle memory of your workers, but are junior level jobs in particular, are they mostly building muscle memory, right? Because that's how a lot of knowledge work works. Like junior workers do what you might call the tedious reps of knowledge work. And if you start to offload a lot of those tasks to AI, you kind of wonder, well, what are those interns and junior workers going to do? And how do they, more importantly, how do they eventually become senior workers? So just because, again, some junior level work you can outsource to an AI and gain some short-term efficiency benefits on maybe your P&L by eliminating positions, that's going to be potentially a long-term hurt for you if you don't have people positioned to take over those senior roles later. So something every organization has to think about.
You mentioned layoffs earlier, and I know for my friends and some of them still working in the industry, or they've already, you know, been laid off and they're asking, what do I do next? And I'm thinking specifically about mid-career or senior veteran journalists who've been doing this for a long time. I know that you made this incredible pivot and, you know, and to me, it feels like you landed well in the space. What would be your advice to others who are thinking, okay, I just got laid off or I'm worried about getting laid off. What can I be doing? I know some folks have gotten certifications, gone back to school, you know, thought about, you know, learning these new skills. What would you advise them to do?
Well, there's certainly that. First of all, I don't know if I've landed. It feels like I'm still floating in a lot of ways because it's hard to keep up with all this stuff and I'm just constantly flying around trying to keep up with it. But certainly upskilling is a really good way to do it, a really good first step. I think there are a lot of free programs. There's a lot of free classes out there. You don't necessarily need to take them all. I would say, you know, look for recommendations from your network for people that you know on LinkedIn. Some of the classes are paid. Like I obviously offer paid classes, but email me if you've been laid off. We'll work something out. We can obviously defer or for some of my more affordable stuff. It's totally free if you need that arrangement. So there's a lot of generosity out there. And mostly I would say though, think about roles where your human judgment, and talking again to the senior people that you mentioned, because what they have is something that is still valuable, if not more valuable in the AI area, which is a very honed human judgment on presumably like a specific beat. And that is something, again, that AI can't quite replicate at this point. AI, even if it is trained and has good training data and good sophisticated prompting, which is definitely not a given these days. I think a lot of organizations are still figuring that part out. Even if you assume that, it's still not the equivalent of human judgment. And you can kind of see this when you ask it to write something for you. And even if you, again, you have a really good corpus, you've done training, you've trained it on your voice, you ask it to write something, it can still get pretty close. But as writers, we all want it perfect. And we know where it's weak. We can see it. And we need to go in and tweak it. It's never going to be that great out of the box perfectly. And that's with a very honed system. So for someone with a lot of experience on a beat, look for places and ways to make sure that that is maximized. You don't want to ever end up at a place where your job is to, say, tweak the AI's work, you know what I mean, and make it sound more human. I mean, there's, again, I'm not knocking AI here. Like, I think there are ways to use AI, even in the writing process, that are good and ethical, like I was just sort of describing about training and that sort of thing. But a lot of places aren't doing that as an organization. If they're just content operations and just sort of determined to put out AI slop, they still need humans to make it sort of sound human. But that's not a great job. There's no future in that. And just making sure that finding something where your human judgment is really maximized. And so there aren't a lot of jobs out there, to be real. Like, you know, I get it. Like, it's all well and good to say that, but there's been a lot of layoffs and the number of jobs are less. I mean, it was just a fact. All organizations now, with the advent of AI, have kind of a mandate to get leaner. So it's going to be tough. I would say, though, as an independent creator myself, who was kind of looking on the precipice of a similar situation about a year ago, you can do something on your own. Now, it doesn't have to be like I founded a company. It's now my full-time job. It's been good, even though it sometimes feels I haven't really landed. But even if you don't want it to be your full-time job and you just want to sort of have a creative outlet or a place to showcase your work as you continue to think about your beat, that's valuable. It's valuable to get that out there because that, again, it's human-driven content, not replicable. And it's frankly, it's just a great way to get your voice out there and help your networking, because networking is going to be the main thing that you need to do to sort of find those openings for where your experience and your judgment are valued.
You've had fascinating discussions with industry leaders, including Cedric the Entertainer. And I listened to your podcast where you talked to the leader of Perplexity. From those conversations, what parallels do you see between AI's use in creative fields like music and its application in journalism?
Yeah, a great conversation with Cedric on recommendation engines, music, how AI can and will be used to not just create content, but recommend content for audiences. With Perplexity in particular, that was a fascinating conversation because I really wanted to get at some of the issues with that I was getting at earlier of the summarization that these engines do and how that is kind of getting in the way of, it is aggregation, but it's aggregation at scale, which we haven't really seen before. So it's a really interesting time, shall we say, in media. So the whole question of content and repurposing it, I think, is a huge huge issue, you know, and it, the ethics of it, the legalities of it, and whether it's music or video or photo or text, there was a de facto rule in the ecosystem where if you were to ingest something like that or scrape it and then provide some kind of service, that through the service, there would be some advantage to whoever enjoyed the thing, right? So there's a reason Google existed and wasn't sued out of existence for scraping the web, because it's linked, although scraping might be the wrong word, indexing the web, but they provided links. Spotify is kind of a different case where, you know, they worked out the economics of it and you know, had a royalty system, et cetera, for all the content they had. So all this stuff works out. So it's like when you're taking content, you're putting it out at scale or doing something with it at scale, an economy needs to emerge somehow. So in the early days of Gen AI with ChatGPT, there was no economy. It was just kind of like assume that, oh, this is like search and we can just use it. Now I would say the arc of history is turning toward that not being the case. That if you look at polling, most people agree that content creators need some form of compensation. And, you know, they're agnostic on what it is, but it's the simple act of like taking something without consent, doing something with it, even if it is transformative. And even though that is what humans do technically, doing it with an AI system at scale, that just doesn't seem right. And again, not a lawyer, but generally that's what sentiments are going to. So the music industry, I think, is really informative here because there's a lot being talked about with regard to voice and artist voices and creating quote-unquote original stuff, like an original Drake song, an original Taylor Swift song done in that style, and putting it out there and potentially making money on that. And if you do, that seems like a fun creative exercise, but it also seems like the artist should have some voice there and not just some like metaphorical voice there in addition to the literal voice, and should be some form of consent and some form of compensation, which might not be as much as if they had done that all song themselves, but let's work out what it looks like. Maybe if you do all the work and you sample their voice and they consent, maybe it's something like 25, 30% they get or something. You know what I mean? Like that, I think that sort of system seems very fair than just letting these AI systems train on any voice that's publicly available and then letting anyone do whatever because, you know, quote unquote, fair use. Yeah, I mean, again, not a lawyer. I just feel like most people can see that there. It's reasonable to say that there should be limits on that and that we still need incentives for the people creating this content because not everyone is Taylor Swift. And, you know, they if their stuff's being used, yeah, they like the exposure, but I'm sure they like money more. And that goes for all other kinds of media.
I like money more. Yeah. And isn't it true that Perplexity recently announced a revenue sharing plan?
Yeah, that's right. When I had a conversation with Perplexity's chief business officer, Dmitry Shrevelenko, and they had recently announced a new side of their business, which is advertising. If the answer uses a publisher's content to create it, they will get a cut of that revenue. And whether or not there are multiple sources and multiple revenue, I'm sure they've figured out all the math. But that is the model. It seems like a decent model. You know, it does obviously require publishers to make some kind of deal with Perplexity. My understanding is that they intend to do this at scale, which is to say they're going to do a self-serve system. So that's something like if you're a small publisher and you have a certain amount of content, you could still sign up for it and not necessarily ever pick up the phone and talk to someone at Perplexity. I'm not sure if that's in place now, but that is the goal. It seems like a good attempt at this. OpenAI's deals are a little different. They're all individually done. They're licensing the content for their training data and their search engine. And at the same time, there are all these, maybe call them a league of federated states of startups that are really trying to architect the economy of this so that, again, smaller publishers have some kind of outlet. So you would go to one of these startups, which has created a marketplace around content for AI systems, and you would basically give the keys to your content and say, okay, I'm pricing it at this level, and then AI companies can pay it or not. And if they do, great, they get access to it. If they don't, they don't. The sort of downside to this, it's not a downside, but a reality of this, is that a lot of this is kind of on the honor system. there's nothing stopping AI companies from scraping and indexing the web. You know, you can do something with your robots.txt file, which is reported all over. So in other words, a signal on your website that says, hey, don't train, don't search, don't index. But that's easily ignored. That said, if someone ignores it and then puts out a public service that clearly has used that content, as we've seen, that can get you into some legal trouble. And, you know, we'll see where all these lawsuits land, whether the New York Times wins or loses, whether there's one against Getty or brought by Getty Images against generative images services. We'll probably get some rulings in the next few months or years. And then, you know, we'll see how that shakes out. But my suspicion is that anyone who has hoovered up stuff and has some stance that they don't need to compensate anyone for that probably is not going to see that ruling that favorable.
Speaking of lawsuits, let's talk a little bit about Google. Google has been a dominant force in the digital world, and recently it's been at the center of some significant antitrust cases. How do you think these legal battles could impact the media industry?
Oh, massively. Obviously, they're appealing it, the whole antitrust thing. So, but even if they do essentially survive in the same current form as a whole company and they don't split off search, that would be the extreme version. I'll get to that version. But even if they don't, I think there's going to be a lot of changes in how Google even approaches different things. Like you thought they were gun-shy before, the idea of leveraging, you know, their search and their AI and using that as some kind of like package deal, conspiring with themselves to do things, you're probably going to see less of that. Good thing to point out here is it's been reported in the New York Times that they harvested their own data from YouTube, even though that's against YouTube's terms of service, to train Gemini. And they obviously didn't complain to themselves, but you can imagine how that might have played out if those were separate companies. So, you know, strong case to be made that search AI, maybe YouTube and a few others might need to separate out. There's just a few different conflicts of interest that are preventing maybe some of these ecosystems from truly evolving in the way they should be. Now, the extreme version where, you know, we get this sort of federated world where Google becomes, you know, 3, 4, 5 different companies, I think will immediately alter the media market. And you're going to start seeing probably like a little more maybe investment in, like, I think that's generally going to be a good thing for media as they basically start, the balance of power starts to shift back toward publishers. For the longest time, Google, Facebook have had most of the ad market and all that power and have been able to leverage their other technologies to cement that power, make sure they stay a monopolistic enterprise. If that goes away, again, I'm not predicting some Shangri-La where the media is as successful as it was in the pre-internet era, but I think you do get an increase of value in that content, which they can then leverage in other ways. So it's going to be exciting. Yeah.
What are your predictions for journalism and the media and the news media industry in particular? I think things are moving so fast. In 2 years' time, in 5 years' time from now.
Okay. I don't think storytelling itself is going to change a whole hell of a lot. I do think as a journalist, we're in this to tell stories. And I think story generation looks very similar 5 years from now, 2 years from now. It's not like you're going to stop writing. It's not like narratives don't matter anymore. Putting facts together in a logical way, all of that will continue. What's going to change is what happens to that piece of journalism when you put it out there. And not just what happens in the media environment, you know, it's going to get hoovered up by Perplexity and ChatGPT and every other system. Although in 2 years' time, I would say that looks pretty fragmented, probably. Like your stories might appear on one AI service, but not another. 5 years now, I know the pendulums tend to swing back and forth, and I think they start to swing faster. So you might start to see 5 years' time another monopoly around foundation models, I think. You know, we have a few today, like maybe a half dozen companies making frontier models. Well, you have Meta doing Llama, you have Google doing Gemini, you have OpenAI doing the GPTs, and You have Mistral. So at least those. I probably might have forgotten some others. And I don't think we have the same group 5 years from now. It might be some version of that group 2 years from now. I'd be surprised if one or two of those wouldn't either drop off or others jump in. But 5 years from now, I feel like the pendulum would probably swing back toward something a little more consolidated. Maybe not one group. I do think over time, those things tend to get simplified. But that sort of presupposes the models matter all that much, right? Because the reason I think it's going to shake out and end up being kind of a monopoly is that they're going to get commoditized and just sort of the best and cheapest ones will simply rise. And I think we're always going to want an open source version, even if OpenAI ends up being that winner. So then I think what that'll do is that'll help simplify sort of the flavor of AI out there. But then it's the access to AI and sort of certain layers and degrees of it in whatever application you're using. So in a media reading app and an aggregator, it's going to largely depend on, again, has the media made a deal with not just OpenAI, but whoever's leveraging that in some novel way that might be serving up advertising or what have you. And depending on if anyone can sort of build a better mousetrap in terms of the aggregation engine. So a good example of this in the pre-AI era is Flipboard. Built a great aggregation display engine. A lot of people became fans. It's still around and people use it on their phones and their tablets, and they have you can create sort of good business models around that. So there might be sort of an ecosystem of these news aggregator apps, but also the companies themselves, like whether you're the Times, whether you're a big operation like that, or a smaller operation that has, less than a dozen people putting out your news, I think you're going to have access to really good off-the-shelf stuff that will sort of democratize this technology that you can offer to your readers. So, chat, we've been talking a lot about chatbots, and I think more media companies are going to offer them on content. We're already seeing that with the Washington Post. I think in 2 years' time, you're going to see that even more, not necessarily as the main thing on a website, but as a way to interact with very specific parts of their content. So the Washington Post right now, they use it for the climate content. I think there's a lot of places where if the content's more evergreen, it makes total sense. Just have a chat. Just tell me the thing I want. I don't want to search for it. I'm just going to ask for the facts, ask for follow-ups. I'll click through if I need to. And thank you very much. And that's a good little interaction because that will give the media, whoever serves up that chatbot, good information about what I want as a loyal reader. And they can keep optimizing to my interactions. So yeah, it's basically going to be, it's going to be very different. And here's what I'll say one more thing about the user experience. I mentioned chat, that'll exist. But I think the level of customization in how we experience information and articles and just content is going to increase more and more. So 2 years from now, I think you see a return of Snoop Dogg reading you the news. And well, that's kind of the gimmicky part of it. But it is like, I want this in podcast form. I want it in short podcast form. I want it in tap through videos. I want it in TikToks. And you could start to do that more and more as, once, like I mentioned, the journalist that puts his story out in the universe, their website or OpenAI or some app that does this in a really clever way will take it, turn it into a story in some other format, do it in a safe, predictable way so that it's not hallucinating. And then suddenly you're TikToking through the New York Times in some novel ways. Maybe not the Times. The Times is a pretty big brand that I think they're going to want to do homegrown stuff a lot. But that level of customization, someone's going to do it. It's going to be interesting, to say the least.
It's like the wild, wild west, right?
Yeah, a little bit.
It's so crazy. I was listening to an AI show the other day, and the person who seemed like an expert knew quite a bit about AI. He said he no longer uses ChatGPT, and he strictly uses Claude.
Claude, once you use these things a lot, you do get to know their quirks. So ChatGPT is very much vanilla McDonald's AI. And I don't mean to say that too pejoratively. ChatGPT is still a very good model, especially if you're using their most recent ChatGPT 4.0. But it is basic. You know, you do kind of need to use custom instructions and memory to really get the most out of it. I'll say this, again, this is my experience, but I do think it tends to be a bit lazier than other AIs. Like, I think this might be a cost mitigation thing. Again, pure speculation on my part, but, you know, everybody knows to go to ChatGPT first for things, and that's got to be weighing on their compute costs. So I got to think, if you're using it for some task and it's sort of giving you 70 to 80% of what you asked for, I find that happens a lot. And then if I sort of iterate, if I do another quick reminder on the prompt, oh, I actually wanted this too, it'll do the full thing. Claude tends to get it more on the first time. Another thing that Claude is good at, prose. Generally, Claude is a better writer out of the box. You can train ChatGPT with custom instructions, with memory, but out of the box, Claude is very good. Sonnet, 3.5 Sonnet is excellent. Opus is good too. Very, very good at writing. And it also tends not to default to a list format when you ask it for things, which I think a lot of journalists prefer. Just give me some prose. So that helps. But the writing is just a level above. It's more variety in the words. You know, it's not like perfect. AI text is always AI text to some extent. But ChatGPT tends to use words like revolutionize and let's delve into this. And, you know, you can obviously tell it not to do that. But I think Claude sort of understands that level of AI marketing speak, I guess I would call it, is mostly what people don't really want. Even marketers, I would argue.
What are some of the tools that you would suggest to journalists who are starting to, yes, I'm going to start using AI now? You mentioned ChatGPT. You mentioned some nuances with Claude.
Yeah, great question. So I would say if you're into ChatGPT, start using memory and custom instructions. You'll do a lot better. Claude now is projects, so mess around with that. Mess around with some prompts. There's a lot of public ones out there on getting it to write more like you. Which again, isn't necessarily saying use that to write articles, but you could use it to write emails and start there and see how that goes. So that's some tips on the common tools. Some tools I would recommend, and these are my recommendations. Well, for voice, 11 Labs is very good. Now, again, some of these are paid, so you can do some good free stuff with 11 Labs. But if you want to mess around with voice tools, that's cool. There's another one called Wondercraft, which is a little more stuff for podcasters, which is kind of interesting. Oh, there's a great group of folks who build a service called Legitimate that's very good for journalists. They have some AI tools in their platform. Legitimate is mostly about a verified profile for journalists, something that would be in the interest of the whole industry if it caught on. But they also have a good transcription tool. So, and by the way, a good transcription tool is Otter. I think that's most people know about Otter. It's got some AI features that are actually okay. I still tend to take my transcripts and put them in other tools. You see, Otter knows that because whenever you do that, they're always, you sure? We got AI too. You want to use our AI? And it's like, nah, kind of like Claude. Thank you. But they're actually pretty good. So if you want to save time, you can use the stuff in Otter. There is this isn't quite AI, but I'm going to name it anyway because it's really useful for journalists. It's Rolly. I've actually got a podcast going up about Rolly soon. The founders are former journalists, one's from CNN. And it's a database of experts. And so they have two kinds of clients, basically. Journalists who use the database and people who want to be in the database. And if you remember back in the day, there was some, actually it still exists. It's called Help a Reporter Out. This is usually for reporters who are on deadline. They need an expert on something. And it was a network of folks that would get in touch. This is that, but even more sort of vetted and verified by fellow journalists. So it's a good service. They're starting to get into some AI tools of just kind of looking at data on social networks or trends rather, and trying to extract some good data for data journalism about that. So that's an extra service that they're starting to provide. But Rolly, it's Rolli. And if you're a podcaster, I would say look into Opus Clip. I think it's getting to be pretty well known now, but I've taught a few teams lately, and I'm always a little surprised about how it's not well known, because Opus Clip is, in my view at this point, the best clipper of a podcast. So it'll take a podcast and give you completely made minute-long clips of the most interesting parts of that podcast. It's super handy. So, and if you are on a team, talked about it already, but Yesio, talk to your product team, or if you are the product manager, just install it. And it's really smart because it'll do what a lot of AI does, which is create SEO optimized headlines and descriptions for your articles, but it does it right where you're working, right? It does it in Slack. And that's the innovation. It's like, if you can do this without needing to do yet another service that you need to log into and cut and paste from, that's always better. And that's, you know, in a lot of newsrooms, that's happening at the product level where they're building it into usually the CMS. That's kind of slow going though. And then you're kind of like, it's hard to, as the content creator, get at the prompting, right? So if it's not a great result, it's not a great product. And that's why it's very important, honestly, when newsrooms design these tools, that the product team really work really collaboratively with the editorial team. Because if it's not saving you time or giving you something good, and I think they have to really agree on what good is, because product often has this minimum viable product thing, which I get it. I speak the language of product. I know why that exists. For something public facing, journalists take their headlines pretty seriously. So it's kind of like the minimum viable product is a little different definition on the newsroom floor. But generally, it's still the dream to make that built into the CMS.
Speaking of, you know, products and expertise and tools, how can listeners find out more about you and the services you provide?
Yeah. So I do the newsletter for the Media Copilot. You can subscribe to that. It's mediacopilot.substack.com. Or you can just go to my main website, which is mediacopilot.ai. Or you can get to the newsletter from there. And on that main website, you can also find the training classes I give. And so check them out. Again, if you have been laid off, you're in some dire straits, just email me, pete@mediacopilot.ai. Happy to chat and we can work something out. But yeah, subscribe to the newsletter. Most of the content's free. And I try to cover this whole intersection of AI and media, both from a macro level, where what is the strategy? What's going on with OpenAI? Why? What are the deals being made? And also the micro level of like, how are journalists and others using these tools?
On that note, I want to thank Pete for joining us today on AI and Journalism. Remember to subscribe to this podcast. All you have to do is go to any of your platforms and subscribe, or you can go to yumiwilson.me to learn more. Until then, I want to thank Pete for joining me today.
Thank you, Yumi. It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for the thoughtful conversation.
I can't wait to hear what you're doing next. And hopefully, you know, maybe in a few months' time, we can have you back on the show to tell us, well, this was going to happen. Give us those predictions and see if they're true.
Well, I hope to feel like I've landed by then. Yeah, it'd be amazing.
Until next time, stay curious, stay informed, and keep exploring the world of AI.
Thanks for listening to AI and Journalism. If you liked what you heard, please hit that subscribe button. You can also connect with me on LinkedIn to share your thoughts and suggest future topics or even guests. And remember to always keep questioning and keep growing.